Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine, the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
In 1776, a date usually, or a year I should say, more thought of in terms of the, first volume of The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, or maybe the Adam Smith or something inconsequential like the Declaration of Independence. But the year also brought the poet William Cumberland, a pretty useless one, but nevertheless, you know, the ordinary ones are always interesting, to write the Ode to the Sun, in which he claimed, quote, "We penetrate the glaciers, traverse the Rhone and the Rhine, whilst our own domestic lakes of Ulswater, Keswick and Windermere exhibit scenes in so sublime a style, with such beautiful colouring of rock, wood and water, backed with so tremendous a disposition of mountains, that if they do not fairly take the lead of all the views in Europe, yet they are indisputable such as no English traveller should leave behind." Now, one of the interesting things about our focus in the last, I think it's 21 episodes, which has been on urban Britain, urban England, I should say, is that urban England, of course, has only been the majority site of the population for less than two centuries. And there has always been an engagement with what one might think of as the rest, whether one wishes to conceptualize it as rural England in the sense of the cultivated, or the countryside in the sense of the country of the cultivated, but also the not cultivated. And the two, of course, link in that wild upland moors, or for that matter, the Lake District as a whole, can still be part of rural England in the sense that sheep are there not just as natural lawnmowers, but also as the source of meat and wool. So I think it's fair to say that with all the focus on the urban identity, it's often the case that the rural identity, or should I say rural identities, of England, or indeed of Britain, or indeed of the British Isles, tend to be underplayed, and particularly so for the 20th century and the modern age. Now, we are seeing at this present moment the emotional and practical resonance of that in terms of the maladroit and inept policies of the new Labour government towards the agricultural interest, which they appear to have largely alienated, though I see they were cheered on by Will Hutton in The Guardian, that well-known centrepiece of writing about rural matters. Anyway, what I would like to do is to pull out some strands, both in this podcast and the next podcast, of the countryside as a theme I'm going to stick to England, I think, in the time available, in English identity and history. And I want, in doing so, to say that it resonates often with those people who, shall we say, are not necessarily aware that it is so important to them. Indeed, I would put it to you that everybody, not everybody, that's going too far, that most of the people, as it were, looking after their allotment in the centre of some urban sprawl, or even doing the same on their garden or on the patio of their block of flats, nevertheless are in fact embracing this engagement with the landscape. And although they may not spend an enormous amount of time there, on the other hand, a combination of the National Trust, going for a walk, the idea that health benefits from actually seeing greenery, the youth hostel movement, a whole host of movements and inclinations engage with rural affairs. And it's very striking, of course, in 2024 to see that the Welsh government, in its zeal to become a non-racist society by 2030, whatever that means, arguing that it's a bad thing to have dogs walking free, because certain ethnic communities apparently find dogs alarming. Well, that may or may not be the case. I have no idea whether the representatives, often self-appointed, of these communities are representative. But the simple point I would make is the idea of the man or woman and their dog is a sublimely English representation of the appeal of the rural, even if it's a matter of just plodding round the local park. Where can I start? Well, obviously, if you think of the arts, one can start all over the place. One can start with music, whether it's, for example, Vaughan Williams. One can start with children's literature, Richard Adams's Watership Down of 1972. One could start with literature more for adults as well as children, such as Henry Williamson's Tarka the Otter of 1927. I think what I might say is that the appeal of the countryside as an aesthetic was pushed much more strongly precisely as an increased number moved in to towns. I think it's fair to say that the approach to the countryside, there are, you know, aesthetic responses. You can see them, for example, in Geoffrey Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. But I think it's fair to say that the appeal of the countryside for most people, in terms of image and reality, was as a rural area of economic activity in which people were very exposed to the elements and in their own way vulnerable to them, even if not necessarily as much as King Lear on the blasted heath. But I think that if one is thinking, for example, of, insofar as we can tell, Roman or Anglo-Saxon or the long centuries of medieval English culture and identity and economic activity, the majority of the population were peasants, the majority of the population worked on the land, and the work was often bleak. And I think it's fair to say that the urban areas tended to attract the elite, however defined, whether they were people living in, trying to embrace the Romanitas of urban life, whether it was Anglo-Saxon bishops and monasteries, many of which were in towns, and so on and so forth. I mean, Brutus in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar refers to the hard hands of peasants. And I think it's fairly reasonable to point out that the economic changes of, for example, the late 14th, 15th, 16th centuries, as population pressures after the Black Death were linked to the situation in which, as was vocally expressed, sheep ate men, the idea of the enclosure of the rural land suggested a rural society that was considerably crueler than our, you know, approach might be. In King Lear, to quote again, I mean, you know, the poor pelting villages in which the, you know, the itinerant beggars suffer unwelcome attention is one, are ones that would have felt themselves under enormous pressure. And Shakespeare is writing against the background of rural discontent, enclosure riots, dearth, in the mid-1590s and in the 1600s, particularly in counties such as Oxfordshire. So I think it's true that you can find echoes of a notion of a rural Elysian in that period, but they're relatively modest. I think what one would say, without sort of rushing too far at once, is that that situation changes, as I've argued, in the late 18th century. Now, in the late 18th century, of course, there is another large spate of rural enclosure. And the idea that land is a commodity and that the commodification of land adversely affects the rural population is one people would have been well attuned to. But I think it's also reasonable to argue that if you're looking at the elite expression of interest in the 18th century, it is very much set forth in a sort of a new era of Palladian country houses, of grounds that stretch down to ha-has, of a kind of remodeling of the countryside by people like William Kent or famously Capability Brown, in which the idea is that excellence and poise are created in many senses by operating outside the town. Now, I'm not in any way ignoring the role of the town in 18th century Enlightenment ideas. What we're talking here is the notion of the countryside in terms of concepts of gentility, and of course, in some respects, the stately home is the idea or the idyll for the new Augustans of the villas they've read about in classical literature. This is Virgil extrapolated into Warwickshire, for example, which helps to account for why so many of these houses were so cold. They hadn't really got that, even though, of course, there was plentiful wood and even more now increasingly coal. So there is then a separate strand, the strand which one might call of the sublime. Now, the sublime is an attitude to landscape that, again, you can find some progenitors, but which is fundamentally begins in the late 18th century. So, William Gilpin's observations relative chiefly to picturesque beauty, made in the year 1772, in which he focuses again on the Lake District, a work published in 1786, or Gilpin's observations on the River Wye, relative chiefly to picturesque beauty, published in 1782. These were works in which, like the painters of the period, people like Thomas Girtin, are very much offering an account of sort of the more wild parts of the English landscape, which are held to represent an aesthetic, but also a source of virtue. And you see that in the early Romanticism, say Wordsworth's Lyrical Ballads of 1798, his Tintern Abbey of the same year. And you see it also in the often overly egged account of abroad. So, crossing the Alps into Italy, Emily in Anne Radcliffe's enormously successful novel, The Mysteries of Udolpho, 1794, writes as following. Well, actually, this is Mrs. Radcliffe writing about Emily. Often as she travelled among the clouds, watched in silent awe their billowy surges rolling below, sometimes wholly closing upon the scene, they appeared like a world of chaos, and at others spreading thinly, they opened and admitted partial catches of the landscape, the torrent whose astounding roar had never failed, tumbling down the rocky chasm, huge cliffs white with snow, or the dark summits of the pine forests that stretched midway down the mountains. Well, that's not quite Hampstead Heath, but what it gives you is the sense of this engagement that becomes, to use a horrible modern word, normative. You get, for example, a route from descriptions like that to Queen Victoria idealising for others, as well as herself, the idea of a Highland life in Balmoral, to the foundation of the National Trust in 1895, by which time a significant part of the landscape of Highland England was devoted to hunting and shooting, hunting for deer, but more particularly shooting for game. Whilst in suburban areas, in contrast, it was a matter of golf courses, the shooting of the middle class, as it were. And what is interesting in both cases is that Victorian men, and you know, there were women who both shot and played golf, but nevertheless, these were preponderantly male activities. The Victorian men expressed their masculinity in part by activities that were very much set in a rural context, even if many of them lived in the town. And of course, Oscar Wilde, in The Importance of Being Earnest, very much presents this, where you will recall that Jack Worthing has his place in the West End, but also, of course, his country seat in Hertfordshire and his Scottish hunting lodge. And I think it's worth bearing in mind that this was a period in which the elite as a whole, I mean, you know, they might often have done a tour abroad as a kind of pre-wedding period. They might have even gone on honeymoon abroad, but more people would have gone, particularly men would have gone shooting or fishing or hunting in rural Britain than would have gone down to the Riviera. And indeed, the sort of first question that a member of the male elite would try and assess when meeting another member of the male elite was, did they preponderantly hunt, shoot, or fish, all of which were rural activities. Now, that in part suggests a class, to use modern terms, a class account of the cult of the countryside. But it's worth bearing in mind that the foundation of the National Trust, the subsequent idea of going hiking round England, Britain more generally, the youth hostel movement, was very much a broader social current. And there was the notion, which you get very much from the 1900s, when you get a condition of England anxiety, famously after the team did so badly against the Maori visitors, famously after the troops that went to serve in the Boer War, so many of them were regarded as, you know, inadequate physical specimens. You get an interest in engaging the bulk of the population with ruralism. That's one of the basis, for example, of Baden-Powell's Boy Scouts movement. It's one of the basis of the yeomanry movement prior to World War One, the idea that the urbanite male should spend their time, their leisure time, in the countryside to good purpose. And for young women, the counterpart, of course, was the extent to which the safety bicycle, what we would call a bicycle as opposed to things like the penny farthing, the safety bicycle meant it was entirely acceptable for young women, unchaperoned, to cycle around in rural areas. And cycling itself, which developed very greatly in the 1890s and 1900s, much more so than driving motor cars in that period, was very much part of the engagement of the urban with the rural. Now, in the interwar period, one can again see elements of this ruralism. If you want, it's too crude in my view, but you can look at my recent history of English culture to see a more nuanced approach. You can argue that modernism was preponderantly urban, but that modernism itself, you know, Virginia Woolf and such like, actually was a minority pursuit, that the majority of writers were those who the modernists disparaged as middle brow. They weren't necessarily middle brow, they were often very skilled writers. And many of these people, Winifred Holtby, for example, for Yorkshire, very much wrote about rural life, rural society. Now, again, if you want, you can argue that there is a political dimension to this, that ruralism was more strong with the Conservatives, that Stanley Baldwin, who led the Conservative Party for most of the 20s and 30s, was very much liked to be associated with ruralism, pipe smoking against farm gates, bringing up pigs, this sort of thing, was all part of his image, which was interesting because, of course, he came from an iron manufacturing background. But the point I'd, and Chamberlain, who Neville Chamberlain, who replaced him, again, came from a Birmingham industrial background. But the point I'm trying to bring out here is that the image of the countryside was actually very strong. In fact, in many senses, it became stronger in the 20s and 30s because suburban semi-detached and detached, which were a large amount of the building of that period, were very much attempts to provide a sort of countryside in towns. And in a way, they were matched with some of, not all, of the council house building of property, which in that period was not one of large system-built skyscrapers, as was to become the case in the 1960s. So what one has got at this moment, and we're going to go on with this and look at this chronologically later in the our next podcast, but what we've got is an attempt to argue that there are a number of differing forms of countryside. So the historian David Underdown, in the early writing about the early 17th century, referred to the chalk and the cheese, arguing that on the chalk lands in southern England, you get a very different social pattern. You know, you get animal husbandry, low population density, a much more independent attitude among the peasantry, whereas in the cheese lands, as he put it, the valley bottoms where there is cattle, there's a, and also wheat, a higher density of population, people live in villages, and there's more, as it were, social control or patterning expressed by the rule of squire and a vicar. Now, I think always one has to be careful and one has to be wary of unitary accounts of any particular contrast between groups, because people have multiple identities. But the point I'm trying to make is that there were many different aspects of the rural societies of England. They were quite nuanced in a way that today most urban commentators simply do not understand. They might see the countryside in aesthetic terms, you know, this area looks more attractive than that, or in terms of the weather, wet west, drier east, you know, colder north, warmer south, this kind of thing. But they are much less likely to be able to understand the differences between contrasting heritages of agricultural practice, areas where, for example, there might have been large estates and relatively few independent owner farmers, instead being tenant farmers, as opposed to areas where there were plentiful independent farmers. And one's talking here not just of abstractions at the country as a whole, rural upland, which was pastoral, cultivated lowland, but one is also talking within the country about very varied and valleys. You know, you could go along and understand that at a particular point you get the spring line. Where you get the spring line, you're most likely to get villages. You might get a degree of rural industry, and the countryside was not necessarily a matter just of agriculture. There was a lot of rural industry and also a lot of rural mining, in the case in particular of coal mining. So you've got variety. You've got the variety of the experience by people that live there, and that interacts, of course, with the other bases of experience and identity, matters such as age, gender, position in the family, such like. You have also got the perception held by those who are, shall we say, the more literate, the more affluent, whether they live rurally or they live urban, or they live in both. And what I have suggested, and there I think we might pause and have a little bit of a discussion, what I have suggested is, without in any way arguing that there was a situation of constancy in the earlier centuries, that would be a foolish proposition. Nevertheless, that the pace of change accelerates in the 18th and 19th centuries, and that this puts concepts and experiences of rural England very much under strain. And the last point is that the great agricultural depression of the late 19th century, which lasts until World War I, the impact on agrarian England and the British Isles more generally, of the import of large quantities of foodstuffs, particularly mutton from Australia, lamb from New Zealand, beef from Argentina and Uruguay, beef from North America, grain from North America, much of this brought in the refrigerated holds of new large steamships. All of that hit agrarian society really hard, as separately did the extent to which tariff reform did not come in for a long time. The consequences being that there was a rapid change of emphasis from a society which in the 1820s and 30s still had a significant rural ethos and composition, to a society within 60 years in which there was a degree of survivalism, in which a lot of the rural population had emigrated or migrated either to the cities or abroad, Australasia or North America particularly, and that instead of this you start to get an empty countryside, empty in inverted commas, which is open to the steady staccato of a line of shooters. Graham.
Well, thank you very much, Jeremy. Goodness, what a fascinating discussion and a very broad canvas you've painted on. So I'm trying, just in questions, just to pick out one or two little pieces of this very grand landscape. And I think my first would be almost trying to find a difference between representations of the countryside and something within that, more specifically, the nature of farming and farm labourer society. So we have in the late 18th century, we've got the lake poets and the wider romanticism, which looks at the force and energy of the countryside, and we have novels set in the countryside, but they're often, not to say exclusively, but they're often set either in the large house or in the more prosperous areas of society, which is in the countryside, but is not the central figures aren't getting their hands dirty. When did this rural idyll, even when it was seen in more negative light, when was there a focus for the general reader on everyday life of farming folk?
Well, that's a fascinating. First of all, you're on the whole absolutely correct. There were one or two writers who did, as it were, come from, shall we say, the more humble elements. So Stephen Duck, the so-called thresher poet of the early 18th century, who had the patronage of the Queen, is an example of that. There were female plebeian poets, Mary Collier, who became a housekeeper on a farm and wrote The Woman's Labour, which was published in 1739, depicted women farm workers, or Mary Leeper, the daughter of a gardener, who wrote a very interesting poem called Crumble Hall. So there are some, and I think it would be mistaken to say that just because literacy is limited, therefore nobody could. And also there are some poems about the bleakness of rural life. I mean, obviously, there's very famously Oliver Goldsmith's Deserted Village of 1770 about the tyrant who has swept away the village for his country house park. Or there's George Crabbe's poem, The Village of 1783, which is based upon, you know, his own experience. And that's about Suffolk poverty and you know, it's pretty bleak stuff. And there are one or two paintings accordingly. But you're absolutely right on the whole. The view of rural life in the 18th century is preponderantly that of the elite. I would say it's more realistic than its French counterpart. I mean, if you're looking at Gainsborough's rural scenes, for example, they're scarcely like Boucher. But nevertheless, it is from the outside. The difficulty is that you've got a populated landscape, and it's much more attractive to write, therefore, in what you might call a pre-romantic or romantic fashion, as with Gilpin or Wordsworth or Cumberland, about the Lake District, because that is preponderantly presented in terms of the landscape, but not of rural society.
Mm-hmm. And a slightly a different question, if I may, just something you touched on quite briefly. Sport, the hunting, shooting, fishing being the sport of the countryside, and distinct from in the 19th century the development of sport and team sport and indeed professional sport, which is mostly in the urban areas, not entirely, but mostly so. I'm just wondering, over the course of the 19th century, whether the investment in hunting, shooting, and fishing increases markedly. I was wondering how, from the 1870s onwards, when we have the Great Depression and agricultural prices, whether more investment therefore went into field sports, or whether actually it's pretty constant over the entire period in terms of interest and value.
Yes, I would say that there was a significantly increased expenditure on field sports. And I would say that the larger number of people involved, I mean, your classic industrialist wanted to blast away. Some of them came from rural society. They were younger sons who'd made good. Some of them didn't. And this is a major source of activity. It's made much easier, of course, by something I haven't yet mentioned. I'm sorry about that. It's not that I forgot, I can only fit in so much, which is that the railway dramatically changed the relationship between the cities and the countryside, so that you could, literally get into a train at King's Cross and Paddington and be in the countryside at greater speed, better value and more pleasure than you would do today. And obviously, one of the classic things that this was used for were people going up shooting. And you see this, but you can see this in people's correspondence from the period. You can see it in newspaper articles. And for those people who are more familiar with literature, you can see it, for example, in the fiction of the period, the ease with which Sherlock Holmes can go bowling off into the countryside, including by train in The Hound of the Baskervilles, which I think I'm right in saying is 1903. And he and Watson, have no difficulty in going. Now, they're there not to, as it were, what they're hunting is reports of a large hound, but they could easily well have been going down there and, having a trap pick them up at the station so that they could bowl along and be blasting away. Some of the other Sherlock Holmes stories, Silver Blaze, for example, are very much set in that kind of milieu.
Well, as you indicate, the railways by the late Edwardian and Victorian period are really opening up the countryside for townies to go where they will. And you mentioned in the course of what you're saying that people in towns were encouraged to go out into the countryside. But other than to go on their safety bicycles and maybe do a brass rubbing, what were they encouraged to do? Was it just to walk around, see around, take in the better air? Or were they actually encouraged to do a bit of farming and some actual physical pursuits out there?
Well, it depends very much about your social milieu. I mean, you do have, hilariously, George III trying to get his sons to take an interest in cultivation, Farmer George, and being rather irritated that none of them reciprocate. I think it's fair to say that the idea of the countryside was not one in which the elite spent their time as manual workers. I mean, you're not going to think of Disraeli's idea of a new sort of English young aristocracy doing that. No, I mean, it is obviously, as we've mentioned, it's sport. It's also sensibility, if you like. It is response to landscape, which you can do by all sorts of things. You can sketch, for example. You can walk and see and take prospects. You can take part in the new hobby of photography. You can read the county guides. We tend to think of the shell county guides of the interwar years. There were county guides in the Victorian period. So there's plenty to see and do. And I think it's fair to say that there is also more leisure activity. Now, ordinary urban workers with excursion trains, many of the excursion trains are going to go from, Nottingham to Cleethorpes, for example, or Manchester to Blackpool, the developing an interest with the seaside, which of course is an aspect of the countryside. But you also get a number, going into the countryside and having a picnic. I mean, I can remember when I was a child growing up in outer London, the idea that you would go into the countryside, which was nearby, sit down on some, blanket in effect, and eat hard-boiled eggs and sandwiches was very, and, let the dog run around, was very much part of a growing up life. There wasn't, I'm not saying it was great or it wasn't great, but it was certainly different from the kind of interest today that people seem to have at a very early age at looking at movable, iPads and so on, which can mean that they can take the image of urban life, metropolitan life, cosmopolitan life, and take it wherever they are.
Well, indeed. Well, very fascinating, Jeremy. I very much enjoyed this, and we will continue it next time. But for now, I'm talking about the idea and indeed the reality of the English countryside. Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.